This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Hyperion, written by Dan Simmons and read by Victor Bavine, Allison Johnson, Kevin Pariseau, Jay Snyder, and Mark Vidor.
Prologue. The Hegemony Consul sat on the balcony of his ebony spaceship and played Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor on an ancient but well-maintained Steinway, while great, green, saurian things surged and bellowed in the swamps below. A thunderstorm was brewing to the north. Bruise-black clouds silhouetted a forest of giant gymnosperms, while stratocumulus towered 9 kilometers high in a violent sky. Lightning rippled along the horizon. Closer to the ship, occasional vague reptilian shapes would blunder into the interdiction field, cry out, and then crash away through indigo mists. The consul concentrated on a difficult section of the prelude and ignored the approach of storm and nightfall. The fatline receiver chimed. The consul stopped, fingers hovering above the keyboard, and listened. Thunder rumbled through the heavy air. From the direction of the gymnosperm forest, there came the mournful ululation of a carrion breed pack. Somewhere in the darkness below, a small-brained beast trumpeted its answering challenge and fell quiet. The interdiction field added its sonic undertones to the sudden silence. The fat line chimed again.
"Damn,"
said the consul, and went in to answer it. While the computer took a few seconds to convert and decode the burst of decaying tachyons, the consul poured himself a glass of scotch. He settled into the cushions of the projection pit, just as the disky blinked green.
"Play,"
he said.
"You have been chosen to return to Hyperion,"
came a woman's husky voice. Full visuals had not yet formed. The air remained empty except for the pulse of transmission codes, which told the consul that this fat-lined squirt had originated on the Hegemony administration world of Tau Ceti Center. The consul did not need the transmission coordinates to know this. The aged but still beautiful voice of Mayna Gladstone was unmistakable.
"You have been chosen to return to Hyperion as a member of the Shrike Pilgrimage," continued the voice.
"The hell you say,"
thought the consul and rose to leave the pit.
"You and 6 others have been selected by the Church of the Shrike and confirmed by the All Thing,"
said Mayna Gladstone.
"It is in the interest of the Hegemony that you accept."
The consul stood motionless in the pit, his back to the flickering transmission codes. Without turning, he raised his glass and drained the last of his scotch.
"The situation is very confused,"
said Mayna Gladstone. Her voice was weary.
"The Consulate and Home Rule Council fatlined us 3 standard weeks ago with the news that the Time Tomb showed signs of opening. The anti-entropic fields around them were expanding rapidly, and the Shrike has begun ranging as far south as the Bridal Range."
The Consul turned and dropped into the cushions. A hollow had formed of Mayna Gladstone's ancient face. Her eyes looked as tired as her voice sounded.
"A force-based task force was immediately dispatched from Parvati to evacuate the Hegemony citizens on Hyperion before the time tombs open. Their time debt will be a little more than 3 Hyperion years.
Mayna Gladstone paused. The consul thought he had never seen the Senate CEO look so grim.
"We do not know if the evacuation fleet will arrive in time,"
she said.
But the situation is even more complicated. An ouster migration cluster of at least 4,000 units has been detected approaching the Hyperion system. Our evacuation task force should arrive only a short while before the ousters.
The consul understood Gladstone's hesitation. An ouster migration cluster might consist of ships ranging in size from single-person ram scouts to can cities and comet forts holding tens of thousands of the interstellar barbarians.
The force joint chiefs believe that this is the ouster's big push,
said Mayna Gladstone. The ship's computer had positioned the hollow so that the woman's sad brown eyes seemed to be staring directly at the consul.
Whether they seek to control just Hyperion for the time tombs, or whether this is an all-out attack on the world web, remains to be seen. In the meantime, a full force space battle fleet, complete with a Farcaster construction battalion, has spun up from the CAM system to join the evacuation task force. But this fleet may be recalled, depending upon circumstances.
The consul nodded and absently raised the scotch to his lips. He frowned at the empty glass and dropped it onto the thick carpeting of the hollow pit. Even with no military training, he understood the difficult tactical decision Gladstone and the Joint Chiefs were faced with. Unless a military Farcaster were hurriedly constructed in the Hyperion system, at staggering expense, there would be no way to resist the ouster invasion. Whatever secrets the Time Tombs might hold would go to the hegemony's enemy. If the fleet did construct a Farcaster in time, and the hegemony committed the total resources of force to defending the single, distant, colonial world of Hyperion, the world web ran the terrible risk of suffering an ouster attack elsewhere on the perimeter, or, in a worst-case scenario, having the barbarians actually seizing the Farcaster and penetrating the web itself. The consul tried to imagine the reality of armored ouster troops stepping through Farcaster portals into the undefended home cities on 100 worlds. The consul walked through the hollow of Mayna Gladstone, retrieved his glass, and went to pour another scotch.
You have been chosen to join the pilgrimage to the Shrike,
said the image of the old CEO, whom the press loved to compare to Lincoln or Churchill or Alvarez Temp or whatever other pre-Hegira legend was in historical vogue at the time.
The Templars are sending their tree ship, Yggdrasil,
said Gladstone.
And the evacuation task force commander has instructions to let it pass. With a 3-week time debt, you can rendezvous with the Yggdrasil before it goes quantum from the Parvati system. The 6 other pilgrims chosen by the Shrike Church will be aboard the tree ship. Our intelligence reports suggest that at least one of the 7 pilgrims is an agent of the ousters. We do not, at this time, have any way of knowing which one it is.
The consul had to smile. Among all the other risks Gladstone was taking, the old woman had to consider the possibility that he was the spy and that she was fatlining crucial information to an ouster agent. Or had she given him any crucial information? The fleet movements were detectable as soon as the ships used their Hawking drives. And if the consul were the spy, the CEO's revelation might be a way to scare him off. The consul's smile faded, and he drank his scotch.
Saul Weintraub and Fedmon Kassad are among the 7 pilgrims chosen,
said Gladstone. The consul's frown deepened. He stared at the cloud of digits flickering like dust motes around the old woman's image. 15 seconds of fat-line transmission time remained.
We need your help,
said Mayna Gladstone.
It is essential that the secrets of the Time Tombs and the Shrike be uncovered. This pilgrimage may be our last chance. If the Ousters conquer Hyperion, their agent must be eliminated and the Time Tomb sealed at all cost. The fate of the hegemony may depend upon it.
The transmission ended, except for the pulse of rendezvous coordinates. Response? Asked the ship's computer. Despite the tremendous energies involved, the spacecraft was capable of placing a brief, coded squirt into the incessant babble of FTL bursts, which tied the human portions of the galaxy together.
No,
said the consul, and went outside to lean on the balcony railing. Night had fallen, and the clouds were low. No stars were visible. The darkness would have been absolute, except for the intermittent flash of lightning to the north, and a soft phosphorescence rising from the marshes. The consul was suddenly very aware that he was, at that second, the only sentient being on an unnamed world. He listened to the antediluvian night sounds rising from the swamps, and he thought about morning, about setting out in the Vikan EMV at first light, about spending the day in sunshine, about hunting big game in the fern forests to the south, and then returning to the ship in the evening for a good steak and a cold beer. The consul thought about the sharp pleasure of the hunt, and the equally sharp solace of solitude. Solitude he had earned through the pain and nightmare he had already suffered on Hyperion.
Hyperion.
The consul went inside, brought the balcony in, and sealed the ship just as the first heavy raindrops began to fall. He climbed the spiral staircase to his sleeping cabin at the apex of the ship. The circular room was dark except for silent explosions of lightning, which outlined rivulets of rain coursing the skylight. The consul stripped, lay back on the firm mattress, and switched on the sound system and external audio pickups. He listened as the fury of the storm blended with the violence of Wagner's Flight of the Valkyries. Hurricane winds buffeted the ship. The sound of thunderclaps filled the room as the skylight flashed white, leaving afterimages burning in the consul's retinas.
Wagner is good only for thunderstorms,
he thought. He closed his eyes, but the lightning was visible through closed eyelids. He remembered the glint of ice crystals blowing through the tumbled ruins on the low hills near the Time Tombs, and the colder gleam of steel on the Shrike's impossible tree of metal thorns. He remembered screams in the night and the hundred-facet, ruby-and-blood gaze of the Shrike itself.
Hyperion.
The consul silently commanded the computer to shut off all speakers and raised his wrist to cover his eyes. In the sudden silence, he lay thinking about how insane it would be to return to Hyperion. During his 11 years as consul on that distant and enigmatic world, the mysterious Church of the Shrike had allowed a dozen barges of off-world pilgrims to depart for the wind-swept barrens around the Time Tombs, north of the mountains. No one had returned. And that had been in normal times, when the Shrike had been prisoner to the tides of time and forces no one understood, and the anti-entropic fields had been contained to a few dozen meters around the Time Tombs, and there had been no threat of an ouster invasion. The consul thought of the Shrike, free to wander everywhere on Hyperion, of the millions of indigenes and thousands of hegemony citizens helpless before a creature which defied physical laws and which communicated only through death, and he shivered despite the warmth of the cabin.
Hyperion.
The night and storm passed. Another storm front raced ahead of the approaching dawn. Gymnosperms 200 meters tall bent and whipped before the coming torrent. Just before first light, The consul's ebony spaceship rose on a tail of blue plasma and punched through thickening clouds as it climbed toward space and rendezvous. 1. The consul awoke with the peculiar headache, dry throat, and sense of having forgotten a thousand dreams, which only periods in cryogenic fugue could bring. He blinked, sat upright on a low couch, and groggily pushed away the last sensor tapes clinging to his skin. There were 2 very short crew clones, and 1 very tall, hooded Templar with him in the windowless ovoid of a room. One of the clones offered the consul the traditional post-thaw glass of orange juice. He accepted it and drank greedily.
"The tree is 2 light minutes and 5 hours of travel from Hyperion,"
said the Templar. And the consul realized that he was being addressed by Het Mastin, captain of the Templar tree ship and true voice of the tree. The consul vaguely realized that it was a great honor to be awakened by the captain, but he was too groggy and disoriented from fugue to appreciate it.
"The others have been awake for some hours,"
said Het Mastin, and gestured for the clones to leave them.
"They have assembled on the foremost dining platform."
said the consul, and took a drink. He cleared his throat and tried again.
"Thank you, Het Mastin,"
he managed. Looking around the egg-shaped room with its carpet of dark grass, translucent walls and support ribs of continuous carved weirwood, the consul realized that he must be in one of the smaller environment pods. Closing his eyes, he tried to recall his memories of rendezvous just before the Templar ship went quantum. The consul remembered his first glimpse of the kilometer-long tree ship as he closed for rendezvous. The tree ship's details blurred by the redundant machine and erg-generated containment fields which surrounded it like a spherical mist, but its leafy bulk clearly ablaze with thousands of lights which shone softly through leaves and thin-walled environment pods, or along countless platforms, bridges, command decks, stairways, and bowers. Around the base of the tree ship, engineering and cargo spheres clustered like oversized galls, while blue and violet drive streamers trailed behind like 10-kilometer-long routes.
"The others await,"
Het Mastin said softly, and nodded toward low cushions where the consul's luggage lay ready to open upon his command. The Templar gazed thoughtfully at the weirwood rafters, while the consul dressed in semi-formal evening wear of loose black trousers, polished ship boots, a white silk blouse which ballooned at waist and elbows, topaz collar cinch, black demi-coat complete with slashes of hegemony crimson on the epaulets, and a soft gold tricorn. A section of curved wall became a mirror, and the consul stared at the image there. A more than middle-aged man in semi-formal evening wear, sunburned skin but oddly pale under the sad eyes. The consul frowned, nodded, and turned away. Het Mastin gestured, and the consul followed the tall, robed figure through a dilation in the pod onto an ascending walkway, which curved up and out of sight around the massive bark wall of the tree ship's trunk. The consul paused, moved to the edge of the walkway, and took a quick step back. It was at least 600 meters down. Down being created by the 1/6 standard gravity being generated by the singularities imprisoned at the base of the tree. And there were no railings. They resumed their silent ascent, turning off from the main trunk walkway 30 meters and half a trunk spiral later, to cross a flimsy suspension bridge to a 5-meter-wide branch. They followed this outward to where the riot of leaves caught the glare of Hyperion's sun.
"Has my ship been brought out of storage?"
asked the consul.
"It is fueled and ready in Sphere 11,"
said Het Mastin. They passed into the shadow of the trunk, and stars became visible in the black patches between the dark latticework of leaves.
The other pilgrims have agreed to ferry down in your ship if the Force authorities give permission,
added the Templar. The consul rubbed his eyes and wished that he had been allowed more time to retrieve his wits from the cold grip of cryonic fugue.
You've been in touch with the task force?
Oh, yes. We were challenged the moment we tunneled down from Quantum Leap. A hegemony warship is escorting us this very moment.
Hetmestine gestured toward a patch of sky above them. The consul squinted upward, but at that second, segments of the upper tiers of branches revolved out of the tree ship's shadow, and acres of leaves ignited in sunset hues. Even in the still-shadowed places, glowbirds nestled like Japanese lanterns above lighted walkways, glowing swing vines, and illuminated hanging bridges, while fireflies from Old Earth and radiant gossamers from Maui Covenant blinked and coated their way through labyrinths of leaves, mixing with constellations sufficiently to fool even the most star-wise traveler. Hetmestine stepped into a basket lift hanging from a whiskered carbon cable, which disappeared into the 300 meters of tree above them. The consul followed, and they were borne silently upward. He noted that the walkways, pods, and platforms were conspicuously empty, except for a few Templars and their diminutive crew-clone counterparts. The consul could recall seeing no other passengers during his rushed hour between rendezvous and fugue, but he had put that down to the imminence of the tree ship going quantum, assuming then that the passengers were safe in their fugue couches. Now, however, the tree ship was traveling far below relativistic velocities, and its branches should be crowded with gawking passengers. He mentioned his observation to the Templar.
"The six of you are our only passengers,"
said Hetmestine. The basket stopped in a maze of foliage, and the tree ship captain led the way up a wooden escalator worn with age. The consul blinked in surprise. A Templar tree ship normally carried between 2,000 and 5,000 passengers. It was easily the most desirable way to travel between the stars. Tree ships rarely accrued more than a 4 or 5 month time debt, making short, scenic crossings where star systems were a very few light years apart, thus allowing their affluent passengers to spend as little time as necessary in fugue. For the tree ship to make the trip to Hyperion and back, accumulating 6 years of web time with no paying passengers would mean a staggering financial loss to the Templars. Then the consul realized, belatedly, that the tree ship would be ideal for the upcoming evacuation, its expenses ultimately to be reimbursed by the hegemony. Still, the consul knew, to bring a ship as beautiful and vulnerable as the Yggdrasil, one of only 5 of its kind, into a war zone was a terrible risk for the Templar Brotherhood.
"Your fellow pilgrims,"
announced Hetmestine, as he and the consul emerged onto a broad platform, where a small group waited at one end of a long wooden table. Above them the stars burned, rotating occasionally as the tree ship changed its pitch or yaw, while to either side a solid sphere of foliage curved away like the green skin of some great fruit. The consul immediately recognized the setting as the captain's dining platform, even before the 5 other passengers rose to let Hetmestine take his place at the head of the table. The consul found an empty chair waiting for him to the left of the captain. When everyone was seated and quiet, Hetmestine made formal introductions. Although the consul knew none of the others from personal experience, several of the names were familiar, and he used his diplomat's long training to file away identities and impressions. To the consul's left sat Father Lennar Hoyt, a priest of the old-style Christian sect known as Catholic. For a second, the consul had forgotten the significance of the black clothing and Roman collar. But then he remembered St. Francis Hospital on Hebron, where he had received alcohol trauma therapy after his disastrous first diplomatic assignment there almost four standard decades earlier. And at the mention of Hoyt's name, he remembered another priest, one who had disappeared on Hyperion halfway through his own tenure there. Lennar Hoyt was a young man by the consul's reckoning, no more than his early 30s. But it appeared that something had aged the man terribly in the not-too-distant past. The consul looked at the thin face, cheekbones pressing against sallow flesh, eyes large but hooded in deep hollows, thin lips set in a permanent twitch of muscle too downturned to be called even a cynical smile, the hairline not so much receding as ravaged by radiation. And he felt he was looking at a man who had been ill for years. Still, the consul was surprised that behind that mask of concealed pain there remained the physical echo of the boy in the man. The faintest remnants of the round face, fair skin, and soft mouth, which had belonged to a younger, healthier, less cynical Lennar Hoyt. Next to the priest sat a man whose image had been familiar to most citizens of the hegemony some years before. The consul wondered if the collective attention span in the world web was as short now as it had been when he had lived there. Shorter, probably. If so, then Colonel Fedman Kassad, the so-called butcher of South Brescia, was probably no longer either infamous or famous. To the consul's generation, and to all those who lived in the slow, expatriate fringe of things, Kassad was not someone one was likely to forget. Colonel Fedman Kassad was tall, almost tall enough to look the 2-meter head mastine in the eye, and dressed in force black with no rank insignia or citations showing. The black uniform was oddly similar to Father Hoyt's garb, but there was no real resemblance between the two men. In lieu of Hoyt's wasted appearance, Kassad was brown, obviously fit, and whip-handle lean, with strands of muscle showing in shoulder, wrist, and throat. The colonel's eyes were small, dark, and as all-encompassing as the lenses of some primitive video camera. His face was all angles, shadows, planes, and facets. Not gaunt like Father Hoyt's, merely carved from cold stone. A thin line of beard along his jawline served to accent the sharpness of his countenance as surely as blood on a knife blade. The colonel's intense, slow movements reminded the consul of an earth-bred jaguar he had seen in a private seed-ship zoo on Lussis many years before. Kassad's voice was soft, but the consul did not fail to notice that even the colonel's silences commanded attention. Most of the long table was empty, the group clustered at one end. Across from Fedman Kassad sat a man introduced as the poet Martin Silenus. Silenus appeared to be quite the opposite of the military man across from him. Where Kassad was lean and tall, Martin Silenus was short and visibly out of shape. Countering Kassad's stone-cut features, the poet's face was as mobile and expressive as an earth primate's. His voice was a loud, profane rasp. There was something, thought the consul, almost pleasantly demonic about Martin Silenus, with his ruddy cheeks, broad mouth, pitched eyebrows, sharp ears, and constantly moving hands, sporting fingers long enough to serve a concert pianist. Or a strangler. The poet's silver hair had been cropped into rough-hewn bangs. Martin Silenus seemed to be in his late 50s, but the consul noticed the telltale blue tinge to throat and palms, and suspected that the man had been through more than a few Poulsen treatments. Silenus's true age might be anywhere from 90 to 150 standard years. If he were close to the latter age, the consul knew, the odds were that the poet was quite mad. As boisterous and animated as Martin Silenus seemed upon first encounter, so the next guest at the table exuded an immediate and equally impressive sense of intelligent reticence. Saul Weintraub looked up upon introduction, and the consul noted the short gray beard, lined forehead, and sad, luminous eyes of the well-known scholar. The consul had heard tales of the wandering Jew and his hopeless quest, but he was shocked to realize that the old man now held the infant in his arms, his daughter Rachel, no more than a few weeks old. The consul looked away. The sixth pilgrim, and only woman at the table, was Braun Lamia. When introduced, the detective stared at the consul with such intensity that he could feel the pressure of her gaze even after she looked away. A former citizen of the 1.3G world of Lussis, Braun Lamia was no taller than the poet two chairs to her right, but even her loose corduroy shipsuit did not conceal the heavy layers of muscle on her compact form. Black curls reached to her shoulders. Her eyebrows were two dark lines, dabbed horizontally across a wide brow. And her nose was solid and sharp, intensifying the aquiline quality of her stare. Lamia's mouth was wide and expressive, to the point of being sensuous, curled slightly at the corners in a slight smile, which might be cruel or merely playful. The woman's dark eyes seemed to dare the observer to discover which was the case. It occurred to the consul that Braun Lamia might well be considered beautiful. Introductions completed, the consul cleared his throat and turned toward the Templar.
Hetmastine, you said that there were seven pilgrims. Is M. Weintraub's child the seventh?
Hetmastine's hood moved slowly from side to side.
No, only those who make a conscious decision to seek the Shrike may be counted among the pilgrims.
The group at the table stirred slightly. Each must know what the consul knew. Only a group comprising a prime number of pilgrims might make the Shrike church-sponsored trip north.
I am the seventh,
said Hetmastine, captain of the Templar tree ship Yggdrasil, and true voice of the tree. In the silence which followed the announcement, Hetmastine gestured, and a group of crew clones began serving the pilgrims their last meal before planetfall.
So the ousters are not in system yet?
Asked Braun Lamia. Her voice had a husky, throaty quality which strangely stirred the consul.
No,
said Hetmastine.
But we cannot be more than a few standard days ahead of them. Our instruments have detected fusion skirmishes within the system's Oort cloud.
Will there be a war?
Asked Father Hoyt. His voice seemed as fatigued as his expression. When no one volunteered a response, the priest turned to his right, as if retroactively directing the question to the consul. The consul sighed. The crew clones had served wine. He wished it had been whiskey.
Who knows what the ousters will do? They no longer appear to be motivated by human logic.
Martin Silenus laughed loudly, spilling his wine as he gestured.
As if we fucking humans were ever motivated by human logic.
He took a deep drink, wiped his mouth, and laughed again. Braun Lamia frowned.
If the serious fighting starts too soon, perhaps the authorities will not allow us to land.
We will be allowed to pass,
said Hetmastine. Sunlight found its way past folds in his cowl to fall on yellowish skin.
Saved from certain death in war, to be delivered to certain death at the hands of the Shrike,
murmured Father Hoyt.
There is no death in all the universe,
intoned Martin Silenus, in a voice which the consul felt sure could have awakened someone deep in cryogenic fugue. The poet drained the last of his wine and raised the empty goblet in an apparent toast to the stars.
No smell of death. There shall be no death. Moan, 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 Cybele, moan, for thy pernicious babes have changed a god into a shaking palsy. Moan, brethren, moan, for I have no strength left. Weak, as the reed. Weak, feeble as my voice. Oh, oh, the pain of feebleness. Moan, moan, for still I thaw.
Silenus abruptly broke off and poured more wine, belching once into the silence which had followed his recitation. The other six looked at one another. The consul noticed that Saul Weintraub was smiling slightly until the baby in his arms stirred and distracted him.
"Well,"
said Father Hoyt hesitantly, as if trying to retrieve an earlier strand of thought,
"if the hegemony convoy leaves and the ousters take Hyperion, perhaps the occupation will be bloodless and they'll let us go about our business."
Colonel Fedmon Kassad laughed softly.
"The ousters don't want to occupy Hyperion. If they take the planet, they'll loot what they want, then do what they do best. They'll burn the cities into charred rubble, break the rubble into smaller pieces, and then bake the pieces until they glow. They'll melt the poles, boil the oceans, and then use the residue to salt what's left of the continents, so nothing will ever grow there again."
"Well,"
began Father Hoyt, and then trailed off. There was no conversation as the clones cleared the soup and salad dishes and brought on the main course.
"You said that there was a hegemony warship escorting us,"
the consul said to Hetmastine as they finished their roast beef and boiled sky squid. The Templar nodded and pointed. The consul squinted, but could make out nothing moving against the rotating starfield.
"Here,"
said Fedmon Kassad, and leaned across Father Hoyt to hand the consul a collapsible pair of military binoculars. The consul nodded his thanks, thumbed on the power, and scanned the patch of sky Hetmastine had indicated. Gyroscopic crystals in the binoculars hummed slightly as they stabilized the optics and swept the area in a programmed search pattern. Suddenly the image froze, blurred, expanded, and steadied. The consul could not avoid an involuntary intake of breath as the hegemony ship filled the viewer. Neither the expected field-blurred seed of a solo ram scout nor the bulb of a torch ship. The electronically outlined image was of a matte-black attack carrier. The thing was impressive in the way only warships through the centuries had succeeded in being. The hegemony spin ship was incongruously streamlined, with its four sets of boom arms retracted in battle readiness, its 60-meter command probe sharp as a Clovis point, and its Hawking drive and fusion blisters set far back along the launch shaft like feathers on an arrow. The consul handed the binoculars back to Kassad without comment. If the task force was using a full attack carrier to escort the Yggdrasil, what kind of firepower were they setting in place to meet the ouster invasion?
"How long until we land?"
asked Braun Lamia. She had been using her comm log to access the tree ship's datasphere, and obviously was frustrated with what she had found, or had not found.
4 hours until orbit,"
murmured Hetmastine.
"A few minutes more by dropship. Our consular friend has offered his private craft to ferry you down."
"To Keats,"
said Saul Weintraub. It was the first time the scholar had spoken since dinner had been served. The consul nodded.
"It's still the only spaceport on Hyperion set to handle passenger vehicles."
"Spaceport?" Father Hoyt sounded angry. "I thought that we were going straight to the north, to the Shrike's realm."
Hetmastine patiently shook his head.
"The pilgrimage always begins from the capital. It will take several days to reach the Time Tombs."
"Several days?"
snapped Braun Lamia.
"That's absurd."
"Perhaps,"
agreed Hetmastine.
"But it is the case, nonetheless."
Father Hoyt looked as if something in the meal had caused him indigestion, even though he had eaten almost nothing.
"Look," he said, "couldn't we change the rules this once? I mean, given the war scare and all? and just land near the time tombs or wherever and get it over with? The consul shook his head.
Spacecraft and aircraft have been trying to take the short route to the northern moors for almost 400 years. I know of none who made it.
May one inquire?
Said Martin Silenus, happily raising his hand like a schoolboy.
Just what the gibbering fuck happens to these legions of ships?
Father Hoyt frowned at the poet. Fedmon Kassad smiled slightly. Saul Weintraub said,
The consul did not mean to suggest that the area is inaccessible. One may travel by ship or various land routes. Nor do spacecraft and aircraft disappear. They easily land near the ruins or the time tombs, and just as easily return to whatever point their computers command. It is merely the pilots and passengers who were never seen again.
Weintraub lifted the sleeping baby from his lap and set her in an infant carrier slung around his neck.
So the tired old legend goes,
said Braun Lamia.
What do the ship logs show?
Nothing. No violence, no forced entry, no deviation from course, no unexplained time lapses, no unusual energy emissions or depletions, no physical phenomena of any sort.
No passengers.
The consul did a slow double take. If Hetmastine had indeed just attempted a joke, it was the first sign in all of the consul's decades of dealing with the Templars that one of them had shown even a nascent sense of humor. What the consul could see of the captain's vaguely oriental features beneath the cowl gave no hint that a joke had been attempted.
Marvelous melodrama,
laughed Silenus.
A real-life, Christ-weeping Sargasso of souls, and we're for it. Who orchestrates this shit-pot of a plot, anyway?
Shut up. You're drunk, old man.
The consul sighed. The group had been together for less than a standard hour. Crew clones swept away the dishes and brought dessert trays, showcasing sherbets, coffees, tree-ship fruits, drams, torts, and concoctions made of Renaissance chocolate. Martin Silenus waved away the desserts and told the clones to bring him another bottle of wine. The consul reflected a few seconds and then asked for a whiskey.
It occurs to me,
Saul Weintraub said as the group was finishing dessert,
that our survival may depend on our talking to one another.
What do you mean?
Weintraub unconsciously rocked the child sleeping against his chest.
For instance, does anyone here know why he or she was chosen by the Shrike Church and the All-Thing to go on this voyage?
No one spoke.
I thought not. Even more fascinating, is anyone here a member or follower of the Church of the Shrike? I, for one, am a Jew, and however confused my religious notions have become these days, they do not include the worship of an organic killing machine.
Weintraub raised heavy eyebrows and looked around the table.
I am the true voice of the tree,
said Hetmastine.
While many Templars believe that the Shrike is the avatar of punishment for those who do not feed from the root, I must consider this a heresy not founded in the Covenant or the writings of Muir.
To the captain's left, the consul shrugged.
I am an atheist,
he said, holding the glass of whiskey to the light.
I have never been in contact with the Shrike cult.
Father Hoyt smiled without humor. The Catholic Church ordained me. Shrike worship contradicts everything the Church defends. Colonel Kassad shook his head. Whether in refusal to respond, or to indicate that he was not a member of the Shrike Church, it was not clear. Martin Silenus made an expansive gesture.
I was baptized a Lutheran, a subset which no longer exists. I helped create Zen Gnosticism before any of your parents were born. I have been a Catholic, a Revelationist, a Neo-Marxist, an interfaith zealot, A bound shaker, a Satanist, a bishop in the Church of Jake's Nada, and a dues-paying subscriber to the Assured Reincarnation Institute. Now, I am happy to say, I am a simple pagan.
He smiled at everyone.
To a pagan, the Shrike is a most acceptable deity.
I ignore religions. I do not succumb to them.
My point has been made, I believe,
said Saul Weintraub.
None of us admits to subscribing to the Shrike cult dogma, yet the elders of that perceptive group have chosen us, over many millions of the petitioning faithful, to visit the Time Tombs, and their fierce god, in what may be the last such pilgrimage.
The consul shook his head.
Your point may be made, M. Weintraub, but I fail to see it.
The scholar absently stroked his beard.
It would seem that our reasons for returning to Hyperion are so compelling that even the Shrike Church and the Hegemony Probability Intelligences agree that we deserve to return. Some of these reasons, mine, for instance, may appear to be public knowledge, but I am certain that none are known in their entirety except to the individuals at this table. I suggest that we share our stories in the few days remaining to us.
Why?
Said Colonel Cassad.
It would seem to serve no purpose.
Weintraub smiled.
On the contrary, it would, at the very least, amuse us and give us at least a glimpse of our fellow travelers' souls before the Shrike or some other calamity distracts us. Beyond that, it might just give us enough insight to save all of our lives, if we are intelligent enough to find the common thread of experience which binds all our fates to the whim of the Shrike.
Martin Silenus laughed and closed his eyes. He said,
Straddling each a dolphin's back and steadied by a fin, those innocents relive their death, their wounds open again.
That's Lanista, isn't it? Said Father Hoyt. I studied her in seminary.
Close,
said Silenus, opening his eyes and pouring more wine.
It's Yates. Bugger lived 500 years before Lanista tugged at her mother's metal teat.
Look, what good would telling each other stories do? When we meet the Shrike, we will tell it what we want. One of us is granted the wish, and the others die, correct?
So goes the myth,
said Weintraub.
The Shrike is no myth,
said Cassad.
Nor its steel tree.
So why bore each other with stories?
Asked Braun Lamia, spearing the last of her chocolate cheesecake. Weintraub gently touched the back of his sleeping infant's head.
We live in strange times, because we are part of that 1/10 of 1/10 of 1% of the hegemony's citizens who travel between the stars rather than along the web. We represent odd epochs of our own recent past. I, for example, am 68 standard years old, but because of the time debts my travels could have incurred, I might have spread these 68 years across well more than a century of hegemony history.
So?
Said the woman next to him. Weintraub opened his hand in a gesture which included everyone at the table.
Among us, we represent islands of time, as well as separate oceans of perspective. Or perhaps more aptly put, each of us may hold a piece to a puzzle no one else has been able to solve since humankind first landed on Hyperion.
Weintraub scratched his nose.
It is a mystery. And to tell the truth, I am intrigued by mysteries, even if this is to be my last week of enjoying them. I would welcome some glimmer of understanding, but failing that, working on the puzzle will suffice.
I agree,
said Hetmastine with no emotion.
It had not occurred to me, but I see the wisdom of telling our tales before we confront the Shrike.
But what's to keep us from lying?
Nothing.
Martin Silenus grinned.
That's the beauty of it.
We should put it to a vote, said the consul.
He was thinking about Mayna Gladstone's contention that one of the group was an ouster agent. Would hearing the stories be a way of revealing the spy? The consul smiled at the thought of an agent so stupid.
Who decided that we are a happy little democracy?
Colonel Cassad asked dryly.
We had better be. To reach our individual goals, this group needs to reach the Shrike regions together. We require some means of making decisions.
We could appoint a leader,
said Cassad.
Piss on that,
the poet said in a pleasant tone. Others at the table also shook their heads.
All right, we vote. Our first decision relates to M. Weintraub's suggestion that we tell the stories of our past involvement with Hyperion.
All or nothing, said Het Mastin. We each share our story, or none does. We will abide by the will of the majority.
Agreed,
said the consul, suddenly curious to hear the others tell their stories, and equally sure that he would never tell his own.
Those in favor of telling our tales?
Yes,
said Saul Weintraub.
Yes,
said Het Mastin.
Absolutely,
said Martin Silenus.
I wouldn't miss this little comic farce for a month in the orgasm bats on Shoat.
I vote yes also,
said the consul, surprising himself.
Those opposed?
Nay, said Father Hoyt, but there was no energy in his voice.
I think it's stupid.
The consul turned to Cassad.
Colonel?
Fedmon Cassad shrugged.
I register 4 yes votes, 2 negatives, and 1 abstention. The ayes have it. Who wants to start?
The table was silent. Finally, Martin Silenus looked up from where he had been writing on a small pad of paper. He tore a sheet into several smaller strips.
I've recorded numbers from 1 to 7. Why don't we draw lots and go in the order we draw?
That seems rather childish, doesn't it?
I'm a childish fellow,
responded Silenus with his satyr's smile.
Ambassador,
he nodded toward the consul.
Could I borrow that gilded pillow you're wearing for a hat?
The consul handed over his tricorn. The folded slips were dropped in, and the hat passed around. Saul Weintraub was the first to draw, Martin Silenus the last. The consul unfolded his slip, making sure that no one else could see it. He was number 7. Tension ebbed out of him like air out of an overinflated balloon. It was quite possible, he reasoned, that events would intercede before he had to tell his story. Or the war would make everything academic. Or the group could lose interest in stories. Or the king could die. Or the horse could die. Or he could teach the horse how to talk.
No more whiskey,
thought the consul.
Who's first?
Asked Martin Silenus. In the brief silence, the consul could hear leaves stirring to unfelt breezes.
I am, said Father Hoyt.
The priest's expression showed the same barely submerged acceptance of pain which the consul had seen on the faces of terminally ill friends. Hoyt held up his slip of paper with a large 1 clearly scrawled on it.
All right,
said Silenus.
Start.
Now? Asked the priest.
Why not?
Said the poet. The only sign that Silenus had finished at least 2 bottles of wine was a slight darkening of the already ruddy cheeks, and a somewhat more demonic tilt to the pitched eyebrows.
We have a few hours before planetfall, and I, for one, plan to sleep off the freezer fugue when we're safely down and settled among the simple natives.
Our friend has a point,
Saul Weintraub said softly.
If the tales are to be told, the hour after dinner each day is a civilized time to tell them.
Father Hoyt sighed and stood.
Just a minute, he said, and left the dining platform.
After some minutes had passed, Braun Lamia said,
"Do you think he's lost his nerve?"
"No," said Lennar Hoyt, emerging from the darkness at the head of the wooden escalator, which served as the main staircase. "I needed these." He dropped two small, stained notebooks on the table as he took his seat.
"No fair reading stories from a primer,"
said Silenus.
"These are to be our own tall tales, Magus."
"Shut up, damn it," cried Hoyt. He ran a hand across his face, touched his chest. For the second time that night, the consul knew that he was looking at a seriously ill man. "I'm sorry, but if I'm to tell my tale, I have to tell someone else's story as well. These journals belong to the man who was the reason for my coming to Hyperion, and why I am returning today." Hoyt took a deep breath. The consul touched the journals. They were begrimed and charred as if they had survived a fire.
"Your friend has old-fashioned tastes if he still keeps a written journal."
"Yes. If you're all ready, I will begin." The group at the table nodded. Beneath the dining platform, a kilometer of tree ship drove through the cold night with the strong pulse of a living thing. Saul Weintraub lifted his sleeping child from the infant carrier and carefully set her on a cushioned mat on the floor near his chair. He removed his comm log, set it near the mat, and programmed the disk key for white noise. The week-old infant lay on her stomach and slept. The consul leaned far back and found the blue and green star which was Hyperion. It seemed to grow larger even as he watched. Hetmastine drew his cowl forward until only shadows showed for his face. Saul Weintraub lighted a pipe. Others accepted refills of coffee and settled back in their chairs. Martin Silenus seemed the most avid and expectant of the listeners as he leaned forward and whispered.
"He said, 'Sin I shall begin the game, what, welcome be the cut, a god's name. Now let us ride, and hearkneth what I say. And with that word we riden forth our way.' And he began with right a merry cheer, his tale anon, and said, as ye may hear."
The Priest's Tale, The Man Who Cried God.
"Sometimes there is a thin line separating orthodox zeal from apostasy," said Father Lennar Hoyt. So began the priest's story. Later, dictating the tale into his comm log, the consul remembered it as a seamless whole, minus the pauses, hoarse voice, false starts, and small redundancies which were the timeless failings of human speech. Lennar Hoyt had been a young priest, born, raised, and only recently ordained on the Catholic world of Pachim, when he was given his first off-world assignment. He was ordered to escort the respected Jesuit father Paul Duret into quiet exile on the colony world of Hyperion. In another time, Father Paul Duret certainly would have become a bishop and perhaps a pope. Tall, thin, ascetic, with white hair receding from a noble brow and eyes too filled with the sharp edge of experience to hide their pain. Paul Duret was a follower of Saint Teilhard, as well as an archaeologist, ethnologist, and eminent Jesuit theologian. Despite the decline of the Catholic Church into what amounted to a half-forgotten cult, tolerated because of its quaintness and isolation from the mainstream of hegemony life, Jesuit logic had not lost its bite. Nor had Father Duret lost his conviction that the Holy Catholic Apostolic Church continued to be humankind's last, best hope for immortality. To Lennar Hoyt as a boy, Father Duret had been a somewhat godlike figure when glimpsed during his rare visits to the pre-seminary schools.
or on the would-be seminarian's even rarer visits to the New Vatican. Then, during the years of Hoyt's study in seminary, Duray had been on an important church-sponsored archaeological dig on the nearby world of Armagast. When the Jesuit returned, a few weeks after Hoyt's ordination, it had been under a cloud. No one outside the highest circles of the New Vatican knew precisely what had happened. But there were whispers of excommunication and even of a hearing before the Holy Office of the Inquisition, dormant the 4 centuries since the confusion following the death of Earth. Instead, Father Duray had asked for a posting to Hyperion, a world most people knew of only because of the bizarre Shrike cult which had originated there, and Father Hoyt had been chosen to accompany him. It would be a thankless job, traveling in a role which combined the worst aspects of apprentice, escort, and spy, without even the satisfaction of seeing a new world. Hoyt was under orders to see Father Duray down to the Hyperion spaceport, and then reboard the same spin ship for its return voyage to the world web. What the bishopric was offering Lenar Hoyt was 20 months in cryogenic fugue, a few weeks of in-system travel at either end of the voyage, and a time debt, which would return him to Pachem 8 years behind his former classmates in the quest for Vatican careers and missionary postings. Bound by obedience and schooled in discipline, Lenar Hoyt accepted without question. Their transport, the aging spinship HS Nadia Oleg, was a pockmarked metal tub with no artificial gravity of any sort when it was not under drive, no viewports for the passengers, and no onboard recreation except for the stim sims piped into the data link to keep passengers in their hammocks and fugue couches. After awakening from fugue, the passengers, mostly off-world workers and economy-rate tourists with a few cult mystics and would-be Shrike suicides thrown in for good measure, slept in those same hammocks and fugue couches, ate recycled food in featureless mess decks, and generally tried to cope with space sickness and boredom during their 12-day, zero-G glide from their spin-out point to Hyperion. Father Hoyt learned little from Father Duray during those days of forced intimacy, nothing at all about the events on Armagast, which had sent the senior priest into exile. The younger man had keyed his comlog implant to seek out as much data as it could on Hyperion, and by the time they were 3 days out from planetfall, Father Hoyt considered himself somewhat of an expert on the world. "There are records of Catholics coming to Hyperion, but no mention of a diocese there," said Hoyt one evening as they hung talking in their zero-G hammocks, while most of their fellow passengers lay tuned into erotic stim sims. "I presume you're going down to do some mission work?"
"Not at all," replied Father Duray. "The good people of Hyperion have done nothing to force their religious opinions on me, so I see no reason to offend them with my proselytizing. Actually, I hope to travel to the southern continent, Aquila, and then find a way inland, from the city of Port Romance, but not in the guise of a missionary. I plan to set up an ethnological research station along the cleft."
"Research?" Father Hoyt had echoed in surprise. He closed his eyes to key his implant. Looking again at Father Duray, he said, "That section of the Pinion Plateau isn't inhabited, Father. The flame forests make it totally inaccessible most of the year." Father Duray smiled and nodded. He carried no implant, and his ancient comlog had been in his luggage for the duration of the trip.
"Not quite inaccessible," he said softly, "and not quite uninhabited. The Bikura live there."
"Bikura," Father Hoyt said and closed his eyes. "But they're just a legend," he said at last.
"Hmm," said Father Duray. "Try cross-indexing through Mamet Spedling."
Father Hoyt closed his eyes again. General Index told him that Mamet Spedling had been a minor explorer affiliated with the Shackleton Institute on Renaissance Minor, who, almost a standard century and a half earlier, had filed a short report with the Institute, in which he told of hacking his way inland from the then newly settled Port Romance, through swamplands which had since been reclaimed for fiberplastic plantations, passing through the flame forests during a period of rare quietude, and climbing high enough on the Pinion Plateau to encounter the cleft and a small tribe of humans who fit the profile of the legendary Bikura. Spedling's brief notes hypothesized that the humans were survivors of a missing seed ship colony from 3 centuries earlier, and clearly described a group suffering all of the classic retrograde cultural effects of extreme isolation, inbreeding, and overadaptation. In Spedling's blunt words, "Even after less than 2 days here, it is obvious that the Bikura are too stupid, lethargic, and dull to waste time describing." As it turned out, the flame forests then began to show some signs of becoming active, and Spedling had not wasted any more time observing his discovery, but had rushed to reach the coast, losing 4 indigene bearers, all of his equipment and records, and his left arm to the quiet forest in the 3 months it took him to escape. "My God," Father Hoyt had said as he lay in his hammock on the Nadia Oleg. "Why the Bikura?"
"Why not?" had been Father Duray's mild reply. "Very little is known about them."
"Very little is known about most of Hyperion," said the younger priest, becoming somewhat agitated. "What about the Time Tombs and the legendary shrike north of the Bridal Range on Equus?" he said. "They're famous."
"Precisely," said Father Duray. "Lennar, how many learned papers have been written on the tombs and the shrike creature? Hundreds? Thousands?"
The aging priest had tamped in tobacco and now lighted his pipe. No small feat in zero G, Hoyt observed.
"Besides," said Paul Duray, "even if the shrike thing is real, it is not human. I am partial to human beings."
"Yes," said Hoyt, ransacking his mental arsenal for potent arguments. "But the Bikura are such a small mystery. At the most, you're going to find a few dozen indigenes living in a region so cloudy and smoky and unimportant that even the colony's own mapsats haven't noticed them. Why choose them when there are big mysteries to study on Hyperion, like the labyrinths?" Hoyt had brightened. "Did you know that Hyperion is one of the 9 labyrinthine worlds, Father?"
"Of course," said Duray.
A rough hemisphere of smoke expanded from him, until air currents broke it into tendrils and tributaries.
"But the labyrinths have their researchers and admirers throughout the web, Lennar. And the tunnels have been there, on all 9 worlds, for how long? 500,000 standard years? Closer to 750,000, I believe. Their secret will last. But how long will the Bikura culture last before they're absorbed into modern colonial society, or more likely, or simply wiped out by circumstances?"
Hoyt shrugged. "Perhaps they're already gone. It's been a long time since Spedling's encounter with them, and there haven't been any other confirmed reports. If they are extinct as a group, then all of your time debt and labor and pain of getting there will be for nothing."
"Precisely,"
was all that Father Paul Duray had said, and puffed calmly on his pipe. It was in their last hour together, during the dropship ride down, that Father Hoyt had gained the slightest glimpse into his companion's thoughts. The limb of Hyperion had been glowing white and green and lapis above them for hours, when suddenly the old dropship had cut into the upper layers of atmosphere. Flame had briefly filled the window, and then they were flying silently, some 60 kilometers above dark cloud masses and starlit seas, with the hurtling terminator of Hyperion's sunrise rushing toward them like a